got the drive to create things. You're a writer, a photographer, a musician, a maker. You're ready to make things happen.
But chasing creative isn't always easy. Your time and energy go to your work, your family, and your life. Is it really possible to make space for the creative in your everyday life?
Here at the Chasing Creative Podcast, we believe you can. We're everyday creatives who have insights and action steps you can take today to make your creative plans happen.
I'm Ashley Brooks, a freelance writer and editor at Brooks Editorial and a work-at-home mom of three who would love to devote more time to creative writing and journaling.
And I'm Abigail Creeves, the writer and photographer behind Inkwells and Images. I'm also a work-at-home mom of one, learning to balance work and home and trying to find a little bit of time to work on something just for fun.
And you're listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Chasing Creative Podcast. Today we have Andrea Debink on with us, and she is an editor and an author with more than a decade of experience in the publishing world. She's currently the editor at American Girl, where she creates nonfiction content that empowers girls to explore their creative potential. Her new book is called Spark, A Guide to Ignite the Creativity Inside You, and it just won a 2018 Moonbeam Children's Book Award. So when Andrea is not creating for her day job, she's often creating for fun and likes to write fiction and essays. She likes to cook and paint with acrylics and watercolors. And in addition to those more traditional creative pursuits, she's also an avid hiker and paddler who loves to explore the outdoors and share her adventures on Instagram. So thank you so much for joining us, Andrea.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I know Abby and I have both recently read your new book, and we are pretty excited to talk to you. My inner child is like squealing with glee because these American Girl books are the ones that I grew up with as a kid, and like taking the quizzes and flipping through the little workbook pages just brought me right back.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so we're going to talk today about your book. Like we mentioned, it's called Spark, A Guide to Ignite the Creativity Inside You. And it's written by you and illustrated by Emily Balsley, I'm going to say.
Yep.
Yeah, and what the book is for anyone who hasn't read it yet, which we're assuming is some people listening to this podcast, it's really an awesome kind of how-to guide for being more creative, for kind of pushing through self-doubt, working your way through critiques of your creative work. Is there anything else that you would use to describe this book, Andrea?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up. It's pretty much just a guidebook to creativity and also the creative process.
So there are a few really cool features that stood out to us. I really liked the creativity sprints where you are supposed to like very quickly like rename your favorite movie or invent a dance move to kind of help you get unstuck. That was one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed how it took you through the entire creative process from start to finish, which is something that like younger people may not have fully thought of. Like, you know, little kids oftentimes like ideas sort of just come to them and they just run with their creativity. But I really like that this walked you through, like, you have an idea, or if you don't have an idea, here's how to find an idea, and walking you all the way through the creative process up until even talking about critiques and getting feedback and how to find those trusted people that you can really trust with sharing your work with. I think that's so important to share with people.
Yeah, you know, and I also think it's really important for this age group in particular, because like you said, younger kids often will just have kind of this unbridled creativity. But by the time they get to that preteen age, which is the age that I do most of my writing for, that inner critic and that self-doubt really starts to creep in at that age. So I thought it was really important to kind of address the whole scope of creativity as a process, like you said, and bring in those different components so that kids aren't discouraged at this age, and that they actually can go on to be creative adults.
Yeah. And so is that what really pushed you to write this specific book for that specific audience in that kind of awkward, formative, preteen age range?
Yeah, it is. The book actually came directly out of my experience as lifestyle editor at American Girl magazine, where I have been an editor for the past 9 years. And most of the content that I create for the magazine is kind of based on creative expression. So I've written a lot of the features on crafts and the DIY content, recipes, activities. So I had kind of wanted to do a magazine article about creativity as a broader topic, since most of the writing I had done was really more specific, like a how-to sort of piece. But as I explored the topic for an article, it became apparent that it was really way too big for a magazine article. I think the longest our articles are in the magazine right now are about 8 pages tops. So I started talking to my boss about it, who is our editorial director, and it really just seemed like it would be a great book because we really had enough content there to fill out something like that. So that's where the original idea first came from the magazine work that I do.
No, that is really cool that they also gave you some creative license there to do something different than what your day job description entails. That's really great. Do you find that is a pretty common thing there at American Girl?
Not always. I think it really, you know, it's funny. I've actually, like I said, been working on the magazine most of the time that I've been at American Girl, and only recently, within the past couple of years, have started working on the nonfiction books as well. And this isn't the first idea I've ever pitched for a book at American Girl. I've probably pitched at least a half dozen before this one that never got made into books. So sometimes I think it's a matter of just having the right idea at the right time. And I think this idea just came along at a time that was right for our audience, for the lineup of books that we were doing, and just all those factors kind of came together. And of course, I had the support of my editorial director, and then also the head of our department to go forward with this idea too.
Yeah, that's awesome that it had, you know, such a great support team surrounding it, I guess. We don't always see that with our creative projects that oftentimes sort of start so small, and it can feel really isolating at the beginning of the creative process if you're not in a place like that with a great creative spirit. So speaking in general about the creative process, is there a part of that that sort of trips you up the most often?
Yeah, definitely. There's probably a few parts of that that trip me up from time to time, but I think the part that I get stuck on the most, or that is the hardest part for me, is getting feedback about my work, especially while that work is in progress, mm-hmm. which, I mean, is true of no matter what sort of creativity I'm doing, but I'm definitely most protective of my writing, which is kind of my main form of creative expression, and it's really hard for me to share my writing with people when it's in progress. I actually kind of hate when people ask me what I'm working on, or what I'm writing, or what my next book is, because usually that the idea is still so raw and unformed that I feel like I can't adequately talk about it to people. So I kind of don't like that question, but I have learned that despite the fact that I don't like getting feedback, and that can be a difficult part of the process, it's actually one of the most beneficial things I'll ever do for my writing and for my creative work. And probably just within the past few years, I've gotten to a place where I realized, okay, if I really want to get better, if I want to really be creating the best writing possible, I need to invite people into that process. And so for me, that's looked like bringing in some friends, or joining a writing class or a writer's workshop where you're in an environment where you're getting feedback, but it's safer feedback.
Yeah.
And it's from people that you trust, and oftentimes people who also have some skin in the game. You know, if you're in a writer's group, someone else is usually sharing their work too. So it's kind of a mutual feedback situation. But it's still the hardest part for me, even though I should be used to it by now. And I think that's just kind of how it goes.
Yeah, I definitely think that is true. I was part of a writing group for a little while and loved it, and it kind of fell apart. People moved, like someone moved to a different country, and it just, we couldn't make the Skype dates work either for us. And I've been trying for the last couple of years to figure out what like the next sort of feedback group looks for me, and haven't quite figured it out yet. Pinned something that is both beneficial to everybody in the group and then also like functional, like easy to get to and easy to do.
Right.
So I am definitely looking forward to at some point diving back into that getting and giving feedback loop. So in Spark, I know you briefly touched on how not to compare yourself with other people on social media, especially when you're going through the creative process. So what advice, do you have any advice for creators when they're struggling to make stuff and promote their stuff, but they really find it hard to kind of see what everyone else is doing and not get stuck comparing what they're doing to what everyone else is?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, comparison is definitely a trap that I fall into myself, especially thanks to Instagram and social media, though I love Instagram and I like social media as a means of discovering new people and work. But yeah, it can be a trap at the same time. And I think one thing that I really benefit from in this area is having this background as a magazine editor, because I know what goes into making something look good for a photo or for presentation. And I know that when you see, you know, a beautiful photo of a finished, you know, craft or a recipe or something, or if you see a beautiful finished book or something like that, I just know that there's a prototype or a rough draft or many of them that I'm not seeing in that picture. So I think someone has a great quote about this, and I don't know what exactly the quote is, but it's something about not comparing your rough draft to like someone else's finished product. And I think that's something to keep in mind when you're looking at Instagram or any place where you're looking at other people's work and it's causing you to start comparing. Just be mindful of the fact that you're not seeing all the work that went into it. So it's not fair to compare where you're at with their final product.
Yes, I think that is, that's like the big joke of Instagram, right? Where sometimes the most Instagram popular famous people will every now and then turn the camera around and show the other side of the room that they don't usually yes. show you. And it's like this huge mess, but then they've got that one gleaming surface with everything pretty and laid out on their desk or their countertops or whatever it is. And it's like, oh no, this is what it really looks like behind the scenes, you guys, this isn't real.
Yep. Yeah. I remember about 5 years ago, I went to Alt Summit. And that was my first time really kind of entering the whole kind of lifestyle blogger influencer world. And I remember there being different workshops on photography and styling for Instagram or your blog or whatever. And I remember being blown away by all these so-called secrets that I was learning, you know, like the ways that people would set up like photo shoots within their own home for Instagram or for their blog. And it was kind of like having the curtain pulled back, you know, like realizing, oh, like people's homes don't actually look like that. They're buying like backdrops and they're buying, you know, tabletop like surfaces that they're shooting on. Everybody doesn't have these amazing kitchens, you know. It was kind of amazing and also just really eye-opening too, to see what goes into all of that.
Yeah, if the average person knew how much work and how many supplies went into making
yes.
things look that way, they probably wouldn't be quite so enamored of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know I've been on the back end of some food styling shoots, which I think you guys do with American Girl a little
yeah.
bit too. And it's amazing, like, the inedible products they use to make food look pretty for a photo. And then you go home
yep.
and you make the recipe and you're like, well, that's why it doesn't look like theirs did.
Mm-hmm.
That's always interesting to me. So speaking of Instagram and everyone's perfect curated feeds, a lot of creative work that we see on Instagram looks really similar these days. And we really wanted to talk to you about what does risk look like in this kind of a creative world when everything you see kind of has similar standards. How do you take a risk and still, I don't want to say fit in, that's not the right word. I guess, how do you take a risk and still, I mean, have a voice in a creative world that kind of looks all the same?
I think one thing I would say, and this is something I've seen other people saying online, so this is not me with my original take on this, but especially as it comes to social media and kind of getting your work seen by the world, you kind of have to forget about the algorithm and understand that, not to put this in too much of a negative light, but you know, there's an algorithm and a system kind of working against maybe getting your work out there in a way that you want it to be.
as a writer, sometimes I feel like, well, I just want to put my words out there and maybe find some sort of connection with other people. But then, you know, you could write this like heartfelt Instagram caption or whatever, and Instagram shows it to like 10 people. And then you have a different picture that's like, you know, you say something totally meaningless and like a throwaway caption, and they show it to everybody, and you just can't control that.
Right. Right. And actually, there is an Instagrammer that I follow. Do you guys know The Lovely Drawer?
I think I've heard of them. Yep.
Yeah. Terry Muncy. She is, I think, in London, and she has a beautiful Instagram account, but she's actually, she does hand lettering and she creates art, and she does a lot of different types of creative work. And I saw her commenting in her Insta stories one day about how the algorithm was just killing her because she was putting all this stuff out there and just nothing was getting seen by her followers. And of course, all of her stuff is beautiful and amazing. And it was kind of, in some ways, comforting to realize, okay, here's this person who's amazing and they're creating incredible work, very successful on Instagram with her number of followers, and she's struggling with this system, mm-hmm. you know, and she feels like her work isn't getting seen. So it's definitely something that affects everybody. Kind of going back to what you said about how everybody's work starts to look the same and that sort of thing, it got me thinking about how early on when I was on Instagram, and actually up until about a year or so ago, I was always really conscious of, okay, like, how do you get seen? Like, what sorts of things rate high? Like, when do you post? And, you know, it was all about the strategy for a while. And one of the strategies that I came back to again and again that people said was to put your own face in your feed, like to take selfies, to, you know, put people in your feed, because apparently photos that have people in them or photos of the actual, you know, person who owns the Instagram account rate higher or will, you know, result in more follows or something. This is what I was reading. I don't know if it's true. and I remember just feeling this pressure like, oh, now I'm going to have to start taking photos of myself. I'm going to start posting that, you know, on my account. And I kind of like made these plans for it. Like, okay, how am I going to like do this? And I just got to this point where I was like, that's not what I want my account to be. And I'm not that I'm camera shy, but I don't necessarily care to have a lot of photos of myself. So, you know, the idea of, you know, you need to post photos of yourself in order to get more likes, more follows, it was like, well, that's not really the work that I want to put out there in the world. I'd rather, like, I mean, if you've seen my Instagram account, a lot of it's nature without mm-hmm. people in it. And that probably doesn't rate as high as, you know, photos of people or selfies or whatever. But I kind of got to this point where I'm like, I don't really care. You know, if people want to see photos of nature, then they're going to come and they're going to stick around and we're going to create this community over that. And if not, then that's okay. Like, we all like different things. And maybe you don't need, you know, 500,000 Instagram followers. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but I feel like just kind of realizing that at some point, your work and what you want to do has to take precedent over getting kind of fixated on your number of followers or even standing out or that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to prioritize the work and put yourself into creating the work that you really care about making and let the following or the platform or any of those other vanity metrics, let all that stuff follow along if it's going to. Like, if that stuff comes, that's fine. Right. But the creative work and expressing yourself is the most important part. And I think that's a helpful shift in perspective when we're always being told, like, oh, you've got to share this and you've got to be everywhere and you've got to build this platform. And it's a nice reminder of, like, why are you doing this? Like, keep your focus on that and the community will come if they want to. And that's fine.
Right. Yeah, and I feel like I particularly struggle with this being a writer. I don't know if you guys have experienced this too, but, you know, I do follow a lot of writers on Instagram, and a lot of them write these incredibly literary Instagram captions, you know, and they write them really regularly and they have lots of eyes on them and readers responding to what they write. And for a while, you know, kind of like the whole selfie thing, I was like, okay, this is where I have to write, because I'm writing books, which are very, like, not instant gratification forms of creativity. I kind of want something in between that's a little faster than book. And I just felt this pressure, like, every caption that I would write on Instagram had to be this beautiful piece of art, you know, instead of maybe just a caption for a photo. And I kind of realized that I was putting a lot of time and energy into my Instagram captions. And that as a result, my kind of more like long form type of writing was suffering from that, because I was actually using my early morning writing time that I normally would be, you know, writing an essay or kind of messing around with a book idea. I was like, you know, obsessing over these Instagram captions. And I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a place for that too, but on one hand, Instagram captions are so here today, gone tomorrow, mm-hmm. you know? And I actually had the opportunity to hear novelist Leif Inger speak last night.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
He was so great. I've never seen him before in person. And what's really interesting about him is, so he's a novelist and he has 3 novels out there. And he said that he's averaging about 10 years between each novel. Mm-hmm. So I think his first novel came out in 2001. And then he had one roughly, you know, 8 to 10 years after that. And now he has one that just came out. And that's just his process. He writes slowly, I guess. And it just got me thinking about what a contrast that is to kind of this rapid fire writing and creating that I feel this pressure to do, largely as a part of social media. But yeah, as a writer, I'd rather be more of a Leif Inger, you know? I mean, to be a writer like that, that sort of novelist would be amazing, but there has to be a trade-off then, because Leif Inger probably isn't on Instagram. Or if he is, I mean, I actually don't even know. He probably isn't, like, spending all his writing time coming up with these quippy captions. So it has to be sort of a balance, I guess. But I just thought that was really interesting to hear about. And I know Anthony Doerr, who wrote All the Light We Cannot See, is the same way. He wrote 10 years to write that book. He took 10 years to write that book, and that's just incredible. Like, spending 10 years with one project. I can't actually imagine that right now.
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion on the podcast before in various forms about how we get so little time to work on our own creative writing these days. As long as, if you're not a full-time artist, you usually are creating in the margins. And I would say that that is, I mean, 99% of the people we've talked to on this podcast, 99% of the people that I know in real life, we're all just creating with the little, like, nooks and crannies that we have. And so you can either spend time creating your art or you can spend time marketing it. There doesn't seem to be enough time for both. Right. So you can do that long form writing or you can write a whole bunch of tweets that day, but you're not necessarily going to get to do both every time you sit down. And so I think Ashley read a book a while ago that talked about kind of the cycle of creativity and how, like, sometimes you're doing that long form writing and sometimes you're just doing marketing, but you can't get stuck in any one part of that cycle for too long.
Right. Yeah. I think I need to read that book.
And I was just thinking of that. I'm like, yeah, it's like that thing I read about the seasons, and I cannot tell you what book that is right now. Like, I'm remembering reading about it. I'm wondering if it's from Deep Work by Cal Newport.
Oh, that makes sense.
It wasn't. It was like a more marketing focused book, but I'll go back through our show notes and look it up, and I'll put it in the link to this show notes, and I'll also send you an email, Andrea.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to read it.
I'm like going through my Goodreads. I'm like, what did I read? Because I remember talking about that, and I remember thinking that is so true. I need to remember this, and I remembered the fact, but I did not remember where it came from.
It wasn't Will It Fly by Pat Flynn, was it?
I don't feel like it was.
I don't either. I'll look it up. We won't spend
we'll figure it out. And we'll put it in the show notes for this episode if anyone is curious.
So talking about how we can get in creative ruts, sometimes we fall into a creative rut even once we find kind of our thing, whether that is like literary Instagram captions or whatever. Do you have anything that helps you break out of a rut and take risks when the time is right?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, what's interesting to me is I don't get into creative ruts as often as I used to. I feel like, especially when it comes to writing, I used to get into them all the time, but that's because I wasn't writing regularly. When I kind of started this practice of getting up early in the morning before my day job and writing, I don't think I've had a creative rut as far as writing goes since I started doing that. And I think part of that is just because you're working those muscles. And over time, it just gets easier, maybe. But I guess overall, like anytime I'm really needing inspiration, I tend to go outside because for me, that's where I can always get inspiration. And I think there's actually some research that shows that walking is really helpful for kind of working out problems in your mind and kind of getting those creative juices flowing. And then also, and this isn't something that's a thing I can do regularly, but I know that whenever I travel, for some reason, that just jump starts creative ideas in my head. And I don't even have to try. It's just a matter of getting out of my everyday experience here and being somewhere else for a while. I'll just like, I have to bring a notebook with me when I travel because that's when all the ideas come. So that happens at least a couple of times a year that I'll be away long enough where I can actually experience that. But yeah, those are really the two big things for me, getting out into nature and stepping away from the screens for a while. And then just traveling when I can.
Yeah, and I love that about like so many people whose work I really admire have come on our podcast and told us about spending time in nature and just getting up and taking a walk. And it's held true, I think, for both Abby and I. And it's just sort of incredible what being in creation can do for our own creative juices.
And I think there's something to, like if you start a creative project, or you know, if I'm writing something and I just can't really get it to work, I love the idea of putting that on the back burner in my mind and then going and doing something else. Because again, I think I've read something about this, but I can't tell you exactly what, and I can't tell you what book it was from. But I believe there's something that happens like when you're writing, even when you're not actively writing, like your mind continues to work on it. And I think that's why like getting outside and walking and not focusing on the writing is so good, because even if you're not consciously thinking about it, your subconscious is like working it out. So I've often taken a break, gone outside, you know, done something away from my desk, come back, and suddenly like the connections that I was trying to make in my mind are there. Mm-hmm. I wish it would happen more often, but it does happen.
Yes, that is the beauty of having many creative projects going on at once. You can sort of put one to the side and, you know, bring out your knitting, or that's what I do. I bring out my knitting and do something with my hands, and then the writing falls into place later.
Yeah.
And so that also sort of leads into our next question, because creativity is a huge part of your job working at American Girl and, you know, coming up with all those DIY projects, like you said. And so how do you take risks when you are on the job and at work, and there are people who are actually sort of judging your ideas, saying this is good enough for the magazine or this needs to be reworked? And then on the other side of that, how do you take risks in your own creative work when you're outside the office, where there's sort of a just like a different atmosphere surrounding your work?
Well, I think when it comes to taking creative risk at work, because you're right, I do a lot of creative work in my day job, and there are usually quite a few people weighing in on that work. In some ways, because of that, I almost feel like I have more freedom to take risk at work. And I think, I was thinking about this, I was trying to figure out why this was, but I think part of it is that I am my own toughest critic, and that no matter what kind of feedback I get, you know, from someone at work or otherwise, it's never going to be as harsh as the critique I give myself. I think having that feedback at my job about my creative work has actually helped me become less of a perfectionist and more free because of that. Because other people are somehow able to set more reasonable expectations for myself than I am. And I also think that over time, as I've been at my job, I mean, obviously my skills have grown, my experience has grown. So I've just, I guess, gained the confidence of the people around me. So I think kind of the longer I've been there, the less feedback I've actually had on my work, because we kind of all, we're a very collaborative team at the magazine. So we all work together really well and kind of trust each other and trust each other's instincts. And that's just something that happened over time, working together for so long. Yeah, so outside of work, I think I constantly have to remind myself to take risks creatively, especially when it comes to writing. And one way that I do that is just to, I don't know exactly what you'd call them, but as I'm sitting here right now, I have about a dozen post-it notes above my computer screen. And each of them just has this little, like, encouraging statement on it that relates to risk. So actually one of them says risk failure on it, and another one says done is better than perfect, which is also a phrase that's in Spark. Another one is good enough is good enough, because I'm a perfectionist and I need to hear that sometimes. So I think just kind of feeding myself these messages that, you know, the only way you learn is to do, and, you know, you have to risk failing. Yeah, and I think also just another way that I'm able to take risks creatively is I have people around me to encourage me. I have a couple of close friends who I think would consider themselves writers, but they don't write regularly. They're definitely readers. And they're the people in my life who actually show my work to. And that encourages me to take risks too. For the same reason that I said already, is they're just, other people tend to be easier on me than I am on myself. So it's another good reason to seek feedback in your work.
Yeah, that is a really good point about other people are always kinder than we are to ourselves. I would think that would be easier to take a risk then, because if you're not putting yourself out there to be critiqued by people who are, you know, quote unquote, as mean as you are, it's much easier to say, hey, look at this cool thing I made. What do you think of it? And go from there rather than be like, I know they're going to say it's awful because I would tell myself it's awful.
Right.
Well, Andrea, we've so enjoyed this conversation on creativity with you. And I know we did not set you up for this to participate in what we call mini book club. We totally completely forgot to even mention it to you. How ridiculous is that, Ashley?
I know. I was looking at the outline. I was like, oh shoot, we didn't put this on here, but we like to talk about books. And if you do too,
I love books.
This would be where we share you can share either something about creativity, something that's really informed your own work as a writer, or just whatever you happen to be reading lately. If there's just a book you want to talk about, just throw it out there.
I think when it comes to books about creativity, first of all, I love reading books about creativity because I feel like I can never learn enough about the topic. A book that really has influenced me over the past couple of years is the book Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, which I know a lot of people have read now. I just found that whole book just really freeing in its discussions about creativity and what that looks like in a person's life. I was particularly encouraged how she talks about how it's okay to have a day job mm-hmm. and you can still be a creator and a writer and whatever else in addition to that. And she kind of blows apart the whole starving artist myth. Because that was a myth that I definitely believed for a while. About a decade ago, I quit the job that I was at. I was an assistant editor at a different magazine and decided that I was going to freelance. And I had no idea what that meant at the time. I just, you know, it sounded really glamorous. And this was like when blogs were just starting and everything. And it was terrible, first of all. I mean, partly because it was 2008 and, like, you know, the sky was falling. But it was also, yeah, just a really difficult time to be freelancing. And I was just, you know, stuck on this idea that in order to be a real writer, I had to, like, have it on my business card. And I had to do that for, like, my rent money and the grocery money. Like, everything had to come from writing. And that was so hard because I definitely didn't make enough to pay rent for a while. But it was still just this myth that I chased for a while until eventually, I mean, I ended up getting this job at American Girl, and that was great. But it was really in reading Elizabeth Gilbert's book a couple of years ago where she's talking about, you know, that's a myth. You don't have to be a starving artist. You don't have to make all of your money from your art for your art to be legitimate. That was something I really needed to hear. And I think that's something that a lot of people really need to hear. So that's reason alone to read that book. And I think I've probably talked a lot about that book now.
Yeah. Well, for good reason, though. We, Abby and I both enjoyed Big Magic, and there were parts of Spark actually that reminded me a little bit of it. So
yeah,
that's a big compliment to you, because I love both of those books now. And as someone who does freelance, and Abby freelances also, I think we could both attest to it's not that glamorous to make all your money from writing when you also want to be a writer for fun. It is not as good as people might think it is.
Yeah, and that's one thing I found too. I thought, oh, well, I'm just going to write my book now, you know, this novel idea that I had forever. But I never wrote my novel when I was freelancing, because all of my writing was writing that I was doing for a paycheck.
Yes.
And, you know, strangely enough, no one wanted to pay me to write my novel at the time. So,
you know, I'm finding that too. It's really kind of a bummer.
Yeah. Oh,
that's what I thought too. Like, I'll quit my day job and then I'll be a freelancer and I'll have all this other time. And instead I ended up like had a baby, accidentally became a freelancer, and now I have zero time. I haven't worked on this novel in like 2 years. Can I even call myself a writer anymore? And all of that thing. So yeah, Big Magic was really encouraging in that vein. And also just the parts where she talks about you're never gonna get over fear. Like, fear is just, you just need to invite it along for the ride and recognize that you're in it. Fear is always going to follow you in your creative pursuits. And I was like, man, because you always look at all of these really accomplished writers and artists and things, and they never seem afraid. And it was so good to hear that even someone like Elizabeth Gilbert is still afraid of writing.
Yes. Well, and that was interesting. That reminds me of last night when I saw Leif Inger speak. We had our books signed by him afterwards, and he thanked us for coming, and he said, yeah, you never really know when you do these things if anyone's going to show up. And he said, I've definitely showed up to an empty room before.
Oh,
and this is a very successful novelist. So, I mean, to hear him say, like, he comes to these author events hoping that people come to see him, I mean, it's kind of comforting.
Yeah, his writing is incredible. So that's definitely saying something. That's if people don't know enough to go to his author events, then that's their problem.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing Big Magic with us. Is there another book that you mentioned that you wanted to chat about?
There is. In that same vein, actually, have either of you read Daily Rituals?
You know, it's been on my list for forever, but I haven't actually read it yet.
Oh, it's great because the chapters are all standalone. So you could just like, you know, read them sporadically. You don't have to like sit down and read a big chunk, but it's by Mason Currie is the author. And the book is just a collection of short essays on different artists, writers, thinkers, and how they approach their work. So kind of talking about what their work day might have looked like, what their sleeping schedule was, how much coffee they drank. Coffee is a very common theme in that book. You'll see a lot of people in that book are big coffee drinkers. But for me, it was really encouraging because you just see the different shape that a creative life can take. It especially resonated with the authors that he talked about. But, you know, he has writers in there who could only write between the hours of 11 and 2, and then the rest of the time they did something else. Or I can't remember the name of the author that he is talking about, but there is a writer in the book who actually worked for 40 years as a mail carrier in England somewhere, and he would get up really early before his job, and he would work on his novels, and he actually was a very prolific novelist. He had a lot of books.
Is it Trollope? Is it Anthony Trollope?
It might be. That sounds vaguely right, but... Yeah, it was this idea that, you know, he had this full-time job that he went to for years and years at the same time that he was writing these novels. And he wrote them, you know, in short chunks of time over a long period of time, but was able to produce a lot of work that way. So I just think it's really an encouraging book because you see that your life doesn't have to fit some sort of mold for the creative life, that there are many different ways to do the work and create the things that you want to create.
Yeah, that is good advice. I feel like I read at one point that Trollope also, like, if he finished a book before he went to work, like, he didn't just, you know, set his papers aside and go to the day job early. He started a new one, like,
oh,
right,
wow,
then and there, which is amazing.
Didn't
want to
waste any time at all.
Yeah, because I'll, like, write a Facebook ad for a client and be like, oh, I need a break now. Going to go do something else.
Yep, feeling real accomplished now.
Yep.
Oh, goodness. Well, that sounds like a book that both Ashley and I would enjoy. So maybe we'll have to pick that one up next.
Yes, thank you for sharing.
I think I've given it away 3 times now as a gift to people. I just keep finding people to give it to. I think it's so applicable to so many people in different ways.
Yeah, that is a great book to give away. So let's go back to your book. And you said Spark came out in August. So this is 2018. So August of 2018. And I assume it's available most everywhere books are sold.
It is. Yep. You can find it on AmericanGirl.com. And you can also find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And of course, I would recommend your independent bookstore, wherever that might be. I'm a big independent bookstore fan.
Excellent. Yes. And we thought, both of us, when we got the book, that it would make an excellent holiday gift for, like, the young preteen gal in anyone's life. So what age group would you say this would be a good gift for, just out of curiosity?
The book is pretty much for ages 8+.
Okay.
And actually, you know, the interesting thing about that is it is American Girl, but I've had plenty of boys come to the book launch events and ask to get it signed, and boys like it too. My nephews have it and have read it, so it just depends on what your kid's interested in.
Yeah, and that can be a tough age to buy for, so this is a really, really great idea, guys. Like, as soon as I bought it, actually, as soon as it came in the mail, my daughters were like, is that for me? And I'm like, let me read it first, then it can be for you. They're a little young for it yet. The oldest is only 4, but I told them that someday it'll be theirs.
Yeah.
That's great. So Andrea, can you tell our listeners where they can connect with you for more creative inspiration?
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram, and that's at Andrea Debbink, D-E-B-B-I-N-K. And then I'm also on Goodreads, and I love connecting with people over books. So I'm also Andrea Debbink on Goodreads. And then they can also find me on my website, which is AndreaDebbink.com.
Excellent.
I just kept it consistent.
Perfect.
Yes. Kudos to you for your consistency. That's well done, branding.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to talk with you guys.
Next up, we'll be diving into our favorite parts of Spark and dishing a little about what taking a creative risk looks like for each of us.
And we're back with just me and Abby now. So our chat with Andrea was so illuminating on how we take creative risks or how we shy away from them. And we really loved reading through Spark and picturing our 12-year-old selves doing the same. So what was your favorite part of Spark, Abby?
Yeah, I really liked the sections about critique and feedback. So Andrea and the illustrator walk you through how to critique a project. And rather than just saying this is good or this is bad, like the example is a drawing of a house, saying like, I like the bright colors that I used and I like the shape of the house, but I didn't like that I couldn't stay in the lines or whatever it happens to be. So critiquing the art, like physically, as opposed to like putting it on a morality scale of good or bad art. I thought that was really insightful and really good for a preteen audience that hears those messages of good and bad pretty much everywhere they go these days. Then the section on getting feedback for your work was really great too, because she mentions how you shouldn't just ask ask any old person for feedback on your work. You need to ask someone who you trust to be honest and kind, and that you don't even ever have to incorporate everyone's feedback on your work. You get to choose, and that I think is a good reminder for anyone trying to put creative work out there.
Yeah, I am amazed at how succinctly she boiled down these really important life lessons that a lot of adults don't even know, and she just managed to fit them into a handful of pages with these gorgeous illustrations, and it's just amazing. It's like, this is like a little pocket handbook that anybody of any age needs to have with them, I think.
Yeah, so what about you? Did a section of the book stick out to you?
It did. So, like we said in the interview, she sort of covers the entire creative process. And my favorite part was when she was talking about actually getting down to the part of the creative process where you have your idea and the only thing that's left is to sit down and do the work of making it. And in this section, she writes, "Most things don't turn out on the first try, not even for adults and professionals. You don't usually see the burned cookies or the photo where the photographer accidentally put her hand in front of the camera, but that kind of stuff happens to everyone a lot." And I just thought that was an incredibly, once again, a really great succinct way to sum up that we often have this idea in our heads that other people know how to do this, and people who are professionals know what they're doing, or people who are older or more experienced know what they're doing. And this is just such a great reminder that everybody feels like they're making things up as they go along. And so you may as well jump in and take that creative risk as well.
Yeah, that is a really good point. And so, speaking of creative risks, what have you done in the past that you would count as a creative risk?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is starting this podcast, because neither of us had any clue what we were doing. We had to do all the research about equipment and how to record. Asking you to co-host with me was a risk because you were a relative stranger on Twitter. We had chatted a few times, but not in depth or anything. And now, like, it's just kind of crazy to see what this podcast has become and what our friendship has become. And it's just, even every time we ask a guest to be on this show with us, it feels risky. And time again, we've been so amazed at the people who have said yes and who have said yes with enthusiasm and been truly excited to chat with us. And even the couple of people that have said no, which has not been that many, it's been, I think, a really good lesson in like, oh, that was no big deal. Like, they said no or not right now. And it was fine. We moved on, and it's totally been a risk worth taking. It's been awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, the world didn't end when they said no, or when, you know, just things didn't go quite as we had planned. We didn't have as much time to chat, or we didn't have as much time to edit or anything. And it has, it's been great.
Yeah.
So it's a risk worth taking.
Exactly. So how about you? Have you taken any other creative risks in the past besides podcasting?
Yeah. I think if you really think about it, it all boils down to, like, everything we do on the internet is a risk. Creating anything and pushing it out there is a risk, whether it's like publishing a blog post or submitting an essay somewhere, or even just writing a really heartfelt like Instagram caption. I feel like I've taken a ton of those like little tiny risks, but maybe not any like big enormous ones. Nothing that is really like sticking in my mind quite like the podcast.
Yeah, but you know what? Tiny risks, I feel like, eventually add up. Just like small steps in any way add up. And maybe even taking a million tiny risks on the internet is preparing you to take like one big risk in the future. So speaking of the future, are there any big upcoming creative risks that you've sort of got your mind on?
Yeah, nothing specific. I have kind of made the decision to take a step back from a lot of my freelance work in 2019. I've crunched some numbers and made some tough decisions, and I think for stress levels and everything, we're going to try to make a little bit more space in life for something yet to come. And I can't even really quite name that yet. I want to, you know, clear some stress off my plate and then see what that kind of time presents itself to, I guess. So having a bunch of external deadlines the last couple of years for clients has been really stressful, and my creativity has definitely suffered, both in scope, like I have no time for anything beyond what has to get done, and in substance, so too tired to make anything meaningful and follow through to the end once you scrape together those little pieces of the day that you have left. So this is a fairly risky thing for me to do because I really like security, and that's something that paychecks bring. But it's also something I'm dealing with like on an identity level. Like I write for clients now, but if I stop writing for clients and I'm not publishing anywhere, or I can't, like I like external deadlines. So if I don't have external deadlines and I'm not actually writing, can I still call myself a writer? And so that's kind of the risk that I'm taking in 2019, is kind of stepping back from the things that I know for sure and walking a little bit more into uncertain territory.
Yep. And I actually feel much the same way about freelancing, where stepping away from it even a little bit does feel like such a drop in security, because it's, you know, freelancing is so unique, and it, we're kind of lucky in that we can drop a client here or there, and it's not like totally quitting your job and just walking into nothingness. But I've been doing something similarly where I, just with having kid after kid after kid, I have just found myself in this season of narrowing, and I just have to keep cutting things down and cutting things down, because to keep it all, I would have had to stay in survival mode for far longer than anyone is meant to. It would have been years, and it would probably still be several more years to come. And so I've, you know, been cutting out a lot of the social media stuff that I used to do. And I have done something similar and pared down to only certain clients. And I have a feeling that I might be making space for something in the future. But right now, I think that something is less of a creative project and more of just remembering how to be a person and a wholehearted, healthy person, so that eventually when there is a creative project waiting in the wings, I will be able to take that risk from a good place.
Oh, that is a really good point. I like that. That's a good distinction. And like you said, having, you know, multiple kids, you figured out what is essential, which is, you know, one of our favorite books, but you figured out what is absolutely essential that you have to keep going, you have to keep doing, you can't drop it. And that you, now you've figured it out. What's the bare minimum? And you can do that.
That is something that every parent needs to do, I think, no matter how many children you have and no matter how old they are.
Yes. And that was in part my decision to kind of take a step back from freelancing too, is at some point we will add to our family, and maybe that will be next year, you know, God willing. But that's, I could not see a future in which I was keeping doing everything that I am doing now and adding a baby to the mix. And so something needed to give. And I suppose I could keep freelancing at the level that I'm at until that baby arrives. But then going from, like you said, survival mode to survival mode just isn't any fun. So carving out a little space before I need it is hopefully something like a gift that I'm giving myself in 2019.
Yes. And so I'm excited to see where this leads both of us, all of our cutting things back and focusing on the important things. And maybe someday, and maybe even next year, we will have some creative risks to share with you guys. We'll have to see what happens. But until then, what we can talk about is mini book club, because no matter how downtrodden we may become with life, we are usually always reading. So what have you been reading lately?
Yeah, that's actually one of the signs that I think of when I enter an unhealthy space, is when I have stopped reading or stopped enjoying reading. So that's definitely a barometer for me. Well, I know Andrea shared some of her favorite creative resources in our chat, and we've talked a lot about those in the past. So rather than rehash them again and again, we're going to talk about what we're currently reading. And I just finished, like 2 days ago, an anthology, I'm going to call it, called Scratch. And it's Writers, Money, and the Art of Making a Living. And it's edited by Manjula Martin. And it's got essays and things excerpted from Cheryl Strayed and Nick Hornby and Roxane Gay and Austin Kleon, who's one of our favorites, and many more people. And it was basically a bunch of writers getting together to talk about the economics of writing. And so some of them talked about like actually what their book advances were and how that helped them in their life. I know, like Cheryl Strayed said, for her book, she got, like, I'm just going to throw a number, like $20,000, and that helped her pay off her credit card debt. And then for like the next book, she got $200,000, which these are numbers that don't exist in publishing anymore. But with that, like, they were able to hire full-time childcare so that she could write the book with her advance money. Like, that is what that kind of money did for her. So it was a really interesting look at some of the actual economic realities of being a writer. And then a lot of the authors too talked about the different things that they've had to give up or set aside to make room for writing because it doesn't necessarily come with a really great paycheck. So I really enjoyed like the whole collection, and I would highly recommend it to anyone who is a writer, whether they write for fun or are trying to make a living at it. I really thought it was very good.
That sounds fascinating. And I know that that whole how do you make a living as a writer or as any sort of creative person is always really high up on a lot of people's curiosity lists. Yeah. And so that sounds like it would be a really great recommendation for people. I am going to have to check that one out as well.
Yeah. So what have you been reading?
So one of my recent reads, I'm in the middle of a bunch right now, but I haven't finished any of them yet. So I'm going to go back a couple weeks to one I finished a little bit ago called How to Be a Happier Parent by KJ Dell'Antonia. And it sounds from the title like it could be one of those obnoxious parenting books that gives you a whole list of things to do and tells you how you're doing parenting wrong. But I listened to the author's podcast. She's the co-host of the hashtag AmWriting podcast, which I highly recommend to any writers. And she also used to be the editor for the New York Times Motherload blog. And so I already knew that guilty, everyone has to do everything my way kind of parenting tips was not going to be her style. So I decided to check out her book, and it was really, really fantastic. And it actually does teach you how to be a happier parent. And some of that is through practical, like raising children from a mom who's been there kind of tips. And some of it is just like, hey, maybe you just need to reframe your mindset. And she has all these mantras for happier parents. So things like, just because your kid is upset about something doesn't mean that you have to be upset. They are a separate person from you. So like if you have multiple children, she has four kids, for example, there's like chances are good that not all four of those kids are always going to be happy. Like someone is probably always going to have an off day. And she's just learned to let it go. She's like, okay, that kid's having a bad day. I feel sorry for that kid. That's like, that's not great, but it's not my day. My day's fine. I can still be happy. So things like that where it's like, oh yeah, like it's really helpful to see things like that. Like, oh, my child is having a tantrum. That does not have to affect my mood. I can choose to still be happy. So I really enjoyed her tips. They were very practical. They were mindset based, and she covers things that talk about embracing the messy parts of parenting rather than trying to make everything perfect. Like, dealing with sibling fights, getting through dinner time, homework battles, all that sort of thing that just comes with the territory with everyday parenting. So I think it's one that I'm going to revisit once my kids get older.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I like the idea of having mantras for those messy moments. I know right now Arthur is in the throes of the like toddler tantrums and they're not fun, but what do you do as a parent when they're in the middle of that? I just keep repeating, like, this is not forever.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you just have to put things in that perspective. Like, those toddler tantrums seem like they are going to last forever, but in reality, that's really just a short handful of years. That admittedly seems like a large handful of years when you stack your children up right in a row like I have, but still, just a season. We will get through it.
Yeah, well, that sounds good. I'll have to add that to my list, too. I haven't read a book on parenting in a while. It's probably time.
And with that, we will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to the Chasing Creative podcast. If you like what you heard in this episode, be sure to stop by chasingcreative.com to check out the show notes, catch up on past episodes, and subscribe to the podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also join in the creative conversation by tweeting to us at Abigail E. Krebs or at Brooks Editorial, or by using the hashtag ChasingCreative on Twitter and Instagram.
If you have any feedback for us, drop us a line at chasingcreativepodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Until next week, go chase your creative.